Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Keesing, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today's Thursday, August 29th, 2013, and we're hoping to have Charles Faddis back again. You may remember from 2 weeks ago, Charles is a former CIA case officer, and he joined us for an absolutely fascinating hour. It was so fascinating that we invited him back again, but he hasn't contacted us yet today, so we're not quite sure he's going to join us, but in the event that he doesn't join us, we do have some headlines we'll be looking at. We're going to take a look at a number of headlines related to, what else, the NSA again. We're going to perhaps take a little look at the situation with competing currencies, something Bill and I have talked about during the week. Also, the big news this week is Syria and whether or not the U.S. is going to bomb, bomb, bomb. Bill was making jokes before the show about that, which shows what kind of sense of humor he's got. Ha, ha, ha. But Bill, you actually get a flavor of what I went through about a month and a half ago when you couldn't make it to the show, and I was trying to fly solo. At least this time we have somebody to talk to.
There you go. I decided I'm going to do a British accent for the show because it sounds so authoritative, and people listen very carefully to what you say, otherwise they wouldn't understand a word.
To all of our British listeners, please, we apologize and hope you accept our apology for Bill's terrible British accent. But actually, it's appropriate that you mention the Brits and the UK because, of course, they're the latest cog in the whole unveiling story about whether or not the Allies are going to bomb Syria for having released chemical bombs. I always wondered about that logic, but, well, never mind. Since Charles hasn't logged on, why don't we start with the Syria story? Bill, you've been doing more reading about it than I have. I have to admit I've been rather cursory with my headlines, but what have you divined from that whole thing?
Well, there has been sporadic, quote, evidence, end quote, of chemical weapons being used in Syria, allegedly by the government agents. Nobody's quite sure exactly what they're using, whether it's sarin or ricin or mustard gas or what it is. And mustard gas is fairly common, and it's used by a lot of police forces around the world. But there really isn't any concrete evidence, which is why they sent these UN inspectors over. Now, there's so much incoherence in the purported intelligence. I just read through a few minutes ago the British report, intelligence report on the Syrian situation.
It was
trying to present the case to Parliament for authorizing military action. But what they cited were open source media. In other words, they read it on the internet. And their evidence was based on video commentaries, which, of course, what they mean by that is YouTube videos created or fabricated by somebody who claims to have taken these pictures in Syria and gives the impression that there may have been some nerve agents involved. So that's like it was with Iraq. It was basically, we read it someplace that they were using gas and chemical weapons in contravention of, UN treaties and that sort of thing.
Really reassuring to know that they're spending $50 billion or something like that every year on spying around the world so that they can hire these guys to go listen to YouTube.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, and read the
paper. For money, you know.
let me just throw in a smattering of odds and ends that I encountered during my research. Purportedly, the most recent attack was August 21st. Is that what I think that's what they said last week? There have been instances of reported use of chemical weapons all the way through 2012. In the war, by one side or the other, or possibly as a consequence of Israel bombing munitions factories, which included chemical weapons. So it's entirely possible that some of these chemical deaths were a consequence of Israel bombing munitions factories. But I did a little further research, and it turns out that the only chemical production plant that exists in Syria is in the northeastern suburbs of Damascus. And it's L'École de la Scientifique, whatever. It's a French building. The French built it decades ago. And that's where they do their research on, you know, either preventing or counteracting chemical weapons. In order to do that, they have to have chemical weapons. Now, it happens that in exactly the same location, northeastern Damascus, is where they claim that the government used these chemical weapons. Now, it's possible that there's residue from this particular, you know, scientific research facility that is residue of sarin gas or some other kind of gas, which they'll find in northeastern Damascus suburbs. Here's the odd part. The odd part is that the northeastern part of the Damascus suburbs is almost entirely agricultural. In other words, there's no real, you know, cities to attack. It's a broad expanse of agricultural land. It's not concentrated populations. So it's very odd if you were going to use sarin gas that you would use it in that kind of an agricultural location. The other problem is that the prevailing winds, I even looked up the prevailing winds in Syria. Prevailing winds during this part of the year, the winter and spring, are from the northeast. So if Syria was going to use chemical weapons in the northeastern suburbs, the wind would carry it back into Damascus. So it makes no sense why they would do that. Now, here's
the thing that we're talking about, though. I mean, politicians are well known for doing things that don't make any sense.
Now, here's the thing they're not talking about, because Israel told them not to. Israel has a capability of intercepting various Syrian military communications. Well, they intercepted a conversation that they translated and provided to the U.S., which was also provided to Britain, in which a low-level commandant in the Syrian army is calling and screaming and yelling at one of his captains for accidentally shooting off some chemical weapons. And he's terribly upset. Now, they can't release that because obviously this guy is pissed off that these turkeys down in the, you know, in the fields, you know, running the munitions, accidentally shot off some chemical weapons. That's not the kind of image they want to portray. They want it to come from Saddam, you know, Assad, you know, ordering his commanders to use these chemical weapons. Otherwise, none of it makes any sense. So they aren't going to release that. Well, at least they aren't going to intentionally release that. It was accidental release through various
sources. I guess that this qualifies as national security. Is that the idea?
Yeah, right, because it was all incidental. However, this conversation apparently took place in May, 4 months ago, and was of no consequence whatsoever. And apparently there were a few people who were killed because they used the wrong munitions. Use the wrong mortars or whatever it was. So using that as a justification for attacking the country just doesn't make any sense at all. So as a consequence, the Prime Minister of Britain is having a real hard time trying to persuade Parliament to authorize the use of force for Britain to participate in some kind of attack on Syria. And today or late last night, whatever the timetable is, the Parliament tabled the proposal until the UN inspectors had reported, and that these UN inspectors are still in Damascus snooping around in the northeastern suburbs. So it was a real defeat for the British government. Now, that's going to piss off Obama, because Obama wanted to get this all over and done with before Congress comes back. The Prime Minister called a special session of Parliament because he thought he was going to get total support and there was going to be no problem, just like before in Iraq. So now Obama's in a quandary, because he's already said, and Joe Biden has said, well, they're using chemical bombs and we got to punish them. But now he's got to get all of this done before September 6th when Congress comes back. And Congress is asking some hard questions. What's the evidence? You know, what does the UN say? Does the UN Security Council support this? Have we, you know, consulted our NATO allies about this kind of attack? What are we going to attack? We're going to attack a depot where there are a bunch of chemical weapons. If we blow them up, we're going to disperse the chemical elements into the atmosphere, and it's going to kill people totally indiscriminately. So there's nobody who's willing to say what they're going to attack or how they're going to attack it in order to, quote-unquote, deter the future use of chemical weapons. So the whole thing just makes no sense to me at all.
Well, heck, when you say it that way. You're right, though. It doesn't make any sense. And it does. We were kind of speculating about this, you and I, between ourselves and email, as you pointed out. This could very easily be a way for the Obama administration to try to deflect attention away from the NSA scandal.
Sure.
I'd say that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, was it a few bombs cost maybe $1 million? It's worth $1 million to get the NSA disclosures off the front pages. You know, stop people talking about Benghazi or whatever else they want to talk about. You know, let's talk about war. Yay, we're killing the bad guys. Hey, aren't we wonderful?
Well, I don't know about you, but I feel so much safer.
There was another amusing phrase, and there was a legal opinion that one of the British legal divisions, put out on whether or not Britain could enforce international bans on chemical weapons. And what they said was, well, you can, but only as a humanitarian gesture. Now, humanitarian bombs, I don't think, have been invented yet. So, what kind of humanitarian intervention are you going to do to deter the use of chemical weapons?
Does a humanitarian bomb like blow up with feathers or something?
Blow it up with feathers. How about a bubble bomb? It just kind of blows bubbles.
Well, tell you what, let's get some expert opinion on this because Charles has called in. Okay.
Good.
So let's bring him in. Charles Faddis, as listeners know, he was with us 2 weeks ago and telling some absolutely fascinating perceptions and ideas and thoughts about the role of the CIA from his perspective as a former case officer for the CIA. And he's joining us again because we had so much fun with him last time. So, Charles, welcome to the program again.
It's great to be back, and I don't know anything about feather bombs.
Aww.
But you worked on bubble bombs, right?
The bubble bomb I know, but I can't talk about that one.
So what's your take? I guess you've been listening into Bill and I scratching our heads over Syria. What's your take on Syria?
I think in general I'm probably as confused as everybody else is. You know, my sort of philosophy on military action abroad is that we ought to be much more circumspect about when we get involved, think much harder about whether we're going to jump in or not, and before we do, be able to break this down to a pretty objective calculus of what are the overriding reasons why the United States of America needs to intervene and how are we going to achieve those objectives so that we know when we're done and we can come home. And it seems to me that if you were to sketch all that out and then find the exact opposite of that approach, that would be where we have ended up in Syria, which is having stayed out more or less for 2 years, we're now going to act purely because the president has talked himself into a corner. And as soon as we start acting, our primary objective will be to terminate the operation and turn around and leave, regardless of what we accomplish and what happens next. So
what do you think of the theory that this is all a distraction trying to point our attention away from the NSA scandal?
You know, I'm sure that that's not an undesirable consequence. I don't know that I buy that that's that's why they've gone down this road. I think that literally they have painted themselves into a corner where now they feel compelled to do something, but nobody can clearly define what that something is. And then as seems to be our want these days, we seem to have lost completely the conception that war involves at least two parties, and that it ends when not when we say it ends, but when the other guy agrees that it ends. Mm. So we're going to go bomb the Syrians, and whatever the hell that means, because I agree with you guys. What are the targets, and what are the consequences? All of that's unanswered. And then we're going to finish firing Tomahawk missiles and dropping bombs, and then celebrate that we have concluded some operation with some cool code name. And then that's not the end, because the Syrians are probably not sailing out into the Mediterranean to confront us. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that they are not going to respond 30 days, 6 months, 9 months down the road in concert with Hezbollah and the Iranians and take out an embassy or strike any, I mean, basically wherever the stars align, wherever their strength matches up with our weakness. And they think they can get away with it, you know. So we'll launch our 72-hour operation. That will not conclude. That will be the beginning of a series of events, not the end.
The consequences, right? Is there a team or a particular department that works on these code names? Because there's a code name for everything under the sun. I mean, even there's a code name for the president.
You know? Well, you just spit out names randomly, you know?
You do have code names and for everything. And that would include, obviously, human sources. So if you have a guy, you know, your man in the Kremlin or whatever, he has to have a code name too. And nobody wants a bad code name. I mean, that sucks. If you've got an asset and he's got a wimpy code name, nobody wants that. So guys will actually compromise code names. I mean, like, deliberately allow the code name to somehow, you know, sort of get out in the open, or I won't go into the details of how that, but basically to force headquarters to issue them a new code name because the code name was unacceptable. Like, you know, I'm not handling puppies in rainbow, you know, or whatever is whatever name you gave the guy.
Well, I think they also do that when they get a lot of bad publicity for a particular project. They just pick up a new code name, and they don't discontinue the project. They discontinue the code name. And I think they've done that a couple of times on the NSA surveillance programs.
Code names get compromised all the time, and particularly code names for people that don't – involving outfits that don't have any idea what they're doing get compromised sometimes multiple times in the course of a year. So, yeah.
Well, it's SOP, essentially.
Total diversion. To get to something serious, one of the topics we didn't get to, and I thought you might have some insights or perspective on from 2 weeks ago, was whether you're aware of or what your thinking was about the policies of torture and rendition.
Yes.
So torture in the sense of what the U.S. was involved in that is euphemistically referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques, is that what we're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, here's my first response, because I think there are, you know, it's a subject with a lot of different facets to it. I mean, to get serious for a moment. I work CT work, basic counterterrorism work, basically from the first day I walked out of training almost. Not exclusively throughout my career, but continuously. So I might have been doing lots of other stuff as well, but really from day one I worked counterterrorism stuff. And that involved, without going into any details of stuff that we can't talk about, quite a number of instances where we had somebody or somebody's in some form of custody, and it was our job to question them. And contrary to what the movies will portray, that was never conducted in anything remotely resembling this use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. Never. And in my opinion...
By you or by the CIA at all?
By me, by... I mean, I will not claim to be able to write you some sort of blank check for the organization as a whole, but I can tell you not by me, not by anybody I was ever associated with, and not by anybody whom I was aware of. For a variety of reasons, it's wrong. That was probably good enough right there that we could stop there. But also, it's amateurish. It produces unreliable information. It's completely contrary to the way interrogation is done, which does not mean, by the way, that I'm suggesting that I was nice to people that were interrogated.
Side for a second, Charles, because that's an interesting word you brought in, amateurish. Tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that this is stuff, all of these techniques, so, I mean, we're talking here about things like waterboarding, are techniques that materialized post 9/11 and were brought into this realm, and frankly, not from within the organization, but from folks that came in from outside the organization. And so, again, contrary to the sort of standard grade B movie portrait of how the CIA operated, the CIA did not function in that fashion. And, by the way, having conducted a significant number of interrogations, I would submit probably as many or more than anybody else running around during my career, we never had any problems with getting information out of people or getting them to tell us what they know, or in some cases to roll over and go to work for us and go back inside on our behalf.
Why is that?
Well, because, I mean, again, there are limits to the details I'm going to go in here, but you don't need to touch a guy or physically harm him in order to put him in a situation in which you have control over him and you can compel him ultimately to break down and tell you what he knows. Let's put it that way. And that's not
like
so.
A hypothetical example. I mean, obviously not a real one, but something hypothetical. What would be an example of that?
Well, I mean, you put a guy in a. I mean, look. Let me get at without being able to go into specific cases. I mean. An individual who finds himself having been wrapped up and in custody, let's take this out of the intel realm for a minute to get at the same psychological note. Criminal defendants all the time find themselves in police stations where they are compelled, usually, not always, but usually without having their heads bounced off walls, to face the reality that if they're going to salvage anything out of their lives, they need to start cooperating and making themselves of use to the police, right? That's standard police work 101. Six guys knocked over a bank. The first guy to talk is the guy who's going to get the best deal, the guy who's going to have the best chance of walking, the guy who's going to have the best chance of salvaging something out of his life. The same kind of psychological dimensions are at play when you're doing interrogation of terrorists. And, yes, I know everybody thinks that these guys are 10 feet tall and they're all mythically completely committed to everything, and certainly there are some like that. Frankly, it's amazing how quickly a lot of that just strips away when a guy is separated from his buddies and he realizes that this is no longer a game. But my point is to say that, look, that the interrogation, sometimes properly called interrogation, sometimes it's really more like an interview, but regardless, I don't want to play semantic word games, was never conducted according to utilizing these techniques. So are they wrong, but I consider them to be amateurish. I think the claims of what they achieved have been grossly inflated. We should have never gone down the road. And I will tell you that when I was in the field inside Iraq, when we first began to hear rumors through the grapevine that, and literally that's the way it was, that perhaps now people were being questioned using, you know, without detail, using techniques that we would have never considered using before. In other words, people were being physically harmed. My direct order to every junior officer working for me was, that does not happen here. I do not care what you hear through the rumor mill or anything else. It is not going to happen here.
So you're saying that in your purview it didn't happen, but you aren't saying that KSM wasn't waterboarded 312 times in Guantanamo. You aren't saying that people in Baghrab weren't hung from the ceiling and et cetera and so on. For you aren't denying that those things happened, but that you didn't.
I'm not denying that it happened. Two things I'm saying to you. First, pre-9/11, in other words, historically in the Central Intelligence Agency, these techniques did not exist. Post 9/11, obviously, I don't probably have any more specific knowledge of some of these cases that you're talking about now than you guys do. So I accept the fact that, which I think is on the record now, that these techniques were used in interrogating a number of different individuals. And that was a massive mistake. Again, number one, because it's wrong. Because at the end of the day, there's got to be a distinction between us and them, or there's no point to having the conflict in the first place. So you don't, the bottom line is there are lines you do not cross. After that, there are a whole lot of freaking practical reasons why you don't do it. Like, who the hell knows what this guy's telling you now? And how you got to it, and whether you can trust any of it.
Yeah. When you use the word amateur, you say what pops into my mind is a schoolyard bully who gets the idea that he is going to have his will dictate everything that goes on the playground by punching people in the face. And that may work momentarily, but it certainly doesn't achieve your objectives in the long term. So are you thinking of it as amateur in that sense? Or and also clarify, because I've read some articles by former FBI agents who were involved in some of these interrogations, and they said, we got all the information we wanted by giving them cookies. We talked to them nice. We made sure they understood they were our friends. We were going to help them out as best we could, and it's a psychological game. And they said that as soon as the FBI got all the information, the CIA came in and started roughing them up and never got any more information at all.
Right. Well, you know why we have an FBI, right? And because their job is to call a press conference 48 hours after the CIA tells them about what they've been doing for the last 2 years, and then take credit for the entire investigation. So I'm going to tell you, having spent significant time, as in sometimes continuously weeks, many, many, many hours a day in the room with the same dude, that you're not getting these guys to tell you what you need to know by simply giving them cookies and milk. Now, there are definitely times when it is definitely a carrot and stick approach. So there are definitely times when, as a reward for somebody having done the right thing, you want to make sure that he gets some benefits out of that. But you're not just going to sit down and talk to them, and the guy who, the day before wanted you all dead suddenly realizes because you gave him a glass of warm milk and a cookie that he should recant his ways. So that's that unfortunately doesn't work that way. What I mean by amateurish is this: the business of collecting intelligence abroad and running these things, it takes a lot of training, and it takes a lot of, first of all, you need to start with the right group of people, which is a pretty eclectic group mix of people. The folks that end up doing this kind of work abroad come from just a vast array of backgrounds. Some of them are, former Army Special Forces, and some of them were backpackers in South Asia for a decade. And then you take this unusual group of people and you train them very, very well. And then you season them abroad, meaning that they spend a huge portion of their lives abroad speaking languages, learning cultures, being used to immersing themselves in somebody else's world. So when they sit down in the room with a guy, they understand how his mind works, his culture, his history, his circumstances, his relationship with his family, the factors that got him there. They know this backwards and forward. They have been swimming in this sea. When you start bringing, since 9/11, everybody and his brother wants to call himself a counterterrorist professional. And they have all come vaulting into this field, many of them with almost no understanding of what they're dealing with. And sometimes their understanding, frankly, is a little cartoonish. It is so simplistic. And that's what I mean by amateurish, is guys that, you know, come into the, it's like, what are we doing here, man? I mean, what you need to, you know, this is a psychological game. This is not about pouring water down this guy's throat.
We're due to take a break here. Let's take that break, and then afterward we'll continue this particularly interesting portion of the conversation. Plus, we're going to ask Charles a little bit about some of the latest news about the NSA and maybe a few other things we have up our sleeves here. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill, with Charles Faddis, ex-case officer for the CIA. And before I get to my question about why it is the CIA finally admitted to the existence of the of having masterminded Iran's coup in 1953, I don't have any idea why they admitted to it, because everybody has known about it for years, but I'll ask about that in a minute. Earlier, Bill asked a very interesting question about torture and rendition. We touched on the torture part, but Bill, why don't you reframe the part about the rendition?
Well, we've been talking about the NSA doing things incidentally or accidentally and not intentionally. And one of the ways to evade responsibility for torture is supposedly rendition. And that just entails sending it to a foreign country who's a friend who's going to do all the torture for us. And I'm just wondering whether you were aware of that as a policy or a procedure or any instances where it occurred under your watch.
So let me break that down, and I'll figure out what pieces of that I can actually answer.
Okay. Fair enough.
I mean, the term rendition basically just refers to the idea of grabbing somebody and rendering them somewhere else. So that in and of itself doesn't necessarily carry any particular connotations, doesn't tell us where the person ends up or any of the conditions or anything else. I mean, in other words, you know, it could be, could end up back in the United States before a U.S. district court. U.S. intelligence obviously works with a whole variety of organizations overseas, in other words, other intelligence and security services. So they're definitely going to cooperate with us folks. Most of these people, that if we're talking in the realm of counterterrorism and we're working abroad, most of these people are not U.S. citizens. So they are definitely going to be the citizens of other countries, and they're definitely going to be, in most cases, wanted by those countries as well as by us. So I think you are always going to have a situation in which people are going to be grabbed one way or the other, whether they're picked up by police, whether they're taken away with a bag on their head, whatever the hell happens to them, and they're going to end up in jails and so forth in other countries. So I think that the issue there, the crux of the issue is, if we then utilize this as a mechanism for effectively attempting to evade responsibility for how those people are treated. In other words, are we not just sending them to country X because they're citizens of that and they're going to hold them, but because we think country X can do things to them that we can't do? I think that has clearly happened, certainly since 9/11. I think it's wrong. I think it shouldn't happen. I don't think it makes a hell of a lot of difference. I mean, if we've grabbed somebody or we have in any way participated in that, and they're being held for us to tolerate conditions that, you know, go beyond the pale, I think that's inexcusable. So again, I can't jump into every detail of every case that's ever happened in the agency. I can certainly tell you this, that no such case ever happened on my watch, and no such case would have ever happened on my watch without me doing whatever it took to bring it to an end, or ultimately saying, well, then here are my papers and I'm resigning because I'm not doing this.
Which supports my proposition that even in the worst places, there are good people with courage.
Well, good. If you could write that down on a piece of paper, and so I can show that to my wife every once in a while, that would be good.
Is this a case of another situation where you believe that any activity that did take place along the idea of using this concept of rendition, basically sending somebody to another country where they're going to be treated more harshly than they are here, that is actually an ineffective approach, that it isn't even necessary?
I absolutely don't think it's necessary. I mean, again, I don't, by virtue of talking about that, I don't want to discount what I've said several times already is the first and most salient point, which is it's just flat out wrong. There are lines we don't cross, and it's not always easy to maintain that, and it's not always convenient, but we need to. That's too bad. You maintain that line, you don't cross it. It is absolutely not necessary. I mean, look, there are lots and lots of details down this road that I can't go into. What I can tell you this is that I have sat in the room and, I've had guys in front of me who'd spent the last 20 years fighting war against the West, who not only told us everything that they knew, but walked out of the door and went to work for us back on the street. And those guys never had a glove laid on them. Were not physically harmed. That does not mean that I was nice to them, or every day with me was a picnic, or that they did not have in many other ways all sorts of incredible pressure put on them to realize that, you know, your life is effectively over. I don't mean like I'm literally going to kill you, but that's where you are now. You have come to the end of the road. If you don't make yourself of value, you're done. Your life is over, your family's life is over, et cetera. There is tremendous psychological pressure there, just like there is for some dude that's sitting in front of a couple of cops in a station house because some guard just got killed in the bank holdup, and he's looking at the possibility of the death penalty or spending the rest of his life behind bars. It's like, man, your entire life is over unless you make you need to make yourself of value to me. This is not about me asking you to do anything. I don't have to do a damn thing. I'm going to go back and watch television and have a beer tonight. You're the one who's done unless you get to work helping me.
Does the, I won't say ease, but does the frequency with which, according to what you're telling us, these people who have spent years trying to in some way take down the U.S., and you effectively turn them so that they're working for us now. Does the fact that happens so frequently say anything that we should be thinking about in terms of just how accurate or inaccurate the claim is that the people who are fighting these battles are fanatic, that nothing will stop them, that they will do whatever it takes to accomplish their aims?
I think there is, without question, has been since 9/11 a tendency to grossly exaggerate the capabilities of our adversaries. That does not, you should not underestimate them. And now we're talking about, right now I'm talking about Muslim extremists, but obviously they are not the entire world of adversaries. But talking about Muslim extremists, you're talking about, and often people who are willing to do almost anything, for whom there are almost no limits or bounds, there are no rules of war, and who are endlessly creative out of necessity because they don't have a giant military-industrial complex, so they better be thinking out of the box all day, every day, or they're done. But they are not 10 feet tall. They are not, you know, super ninjas. And, you know, taken out of that structure and faced with the end of the road, and they will break like virtually anybody will break. You know, they will face the reality of their situation.
So you're saying they're not crazy? I'm trying to beat around the bush here. I mean, how deep is religious fanaticism when you encountered it? Are there people that are just totally committed, you know, religiously to destroying the West, or you know?
Well, clearly there are people who have very, 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 very deep religious commitments. But this is back to something I was talking about before. Look, the business of this kind of intelligence, human intelligence, and this I think is a critical factor that we have really lost the bubble on since 9/11, is not something that can be mass produced. it's not something that, I mean, we have tried, God knows we've tried to waste, and we are wasting billions of dollars on a bloated bureaucracy and a bloated apparatus. But it is really not something you can mass produce. You can't mass produce case officers and operations officers. I mean, you can, but you won't really, I mean, you can stick the label on them, but it would be like trying to have a National Basketball Association with 100,000 guys in it. Well, you might have 100,000 guys dribbling basketballs, but it's not the same NBA, you know, at best.
No, what I'm talking about is not about on our side. I'm talking about on their side. The perception that people try to create is that there is a subset of Muslims who are totally crazed, religious fanatics, kamikazes, whatever. The ones that you encountered, were they crazy or were they sane? In other words, did they respond?
I mean, there are crazy people everywhere, but by and large, no, crazy is not the issue. But I guess where I was going with my previous comments was, look, if I'm sitting in the room with a guy who has been absolutely committed to the idea that violent jihad is the way he needs to save, is the answer to all of the ills of the world, what is going to turn him and break him and convince him to and get him to find his way to a rationalization which will allow him to work with me is the fact that the person sitting in the room with him spent the last quarter of a century in the Middle East, knows his culture, understands what he's saying, understands and can climb inside his skull and psychologically make that happen. Not some guy who went to a school for 6 months somewhere in the United States and read the Army Field Manual on how to interrogate people. So at the end of the day, he may still be a very devout, very fundamentalist Muslim. He may still believe that the West is, in fact, a bad influence, and the only thing that may have flipped in his mind is that he may have decided that violent jihad, that violence is not the answer. So he may still find me the agent of a decadent culture that is, by and large, not a particularly good influence anywhere in the world, and he may still believe that he should be as devout as possible and his wife should be covered and everything else. If all he has decided is that the answer is not blowing people up and that needs to stop, then we're there.
That's all you need. Okay.
You recently came out with a novel that addresses the topic of biological warfare, which is not something that gets a lot of attention in news media. I mean, obviously Syria, for instance, is about chemical weapons. But just the fact that you brought that out in your novel suggests to me that's an important topic to you. First of all, is it an important topic to you? And second of all, do you see a connection there to the kind of people you were talking about, the Muslim fanatics, or not so much fanatics, but the Muslim activists who, you know, did everything they could to try to bring down the American devil and so forth? Is there a connection going on there in your mind in terms of telling that story, or is the story just about the risks and problems involved with trying to deal with a potential biological attack?
No, I think there's definitely a connection there. I mean, to answer the first question first, I think there are a number of different types of weapons that are loosely referred to as weapons of mass destruction. So nuclear weapons, radiological weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, all nasty stuff. But if you talk to weapons of mass destruction experts worldwide, people who follow terrorist groups and worry about this, they will, to a man, to a woman, tell you that biological weapons are the number one threat, the number one real near-term threat for a true mass casualty event, something that would kill thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions. That it is not fiction, it is not it's not fantasy, and it's way too real, and there's way too much risk of it. So part of the reason I wrote the latest book called CAFFA, C-A-F-F-A, about that was because it's an important topic. But the plot is predicated on going back to not just the issue of fanaticism, but the issue of thinking out of the box. Because, you know, our answer to everything is to spend $100 billion and create a new agency. Mm-hmm. When you don't have $100 billion and endless manpower, you tend to come up with some incredibly creative ways to respond. So, you know, 9/11 from that perspective was brilliant. I mean, sick, twisted, horrible, unjustifiable, but brilliant because they understood our hostage, our policy for hijacking of airlines and knew that every crew in the United States had been trained not to resist hijackers and get the plane on the ground where hostage rescue forces could respond. So you pretty much show almost any weapon and you're going to be told, yeah, that's fine, dude. We're not going to hassle you. Let's just land the plane. They understood that as basically jujitsu. They used it against us, and it wasn't until several planes have gone into targets that we realize exactly what's happening. So the idea in CAFA is that what happens is these individuals deliberately infect members of their own group with a disease which is communicable human to human. And that is the method of delivery, is by simply having those people transmit that disease to every person they encounter as they move around.
Now, I've got a really challenging question, and I'm not even sure if you can answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Why is it we haven't seen a biological attack?
Beyond anthrax.
Yeah.
Yeah, beyond anthrax, which originated in one of our own labs, by the way.
Exactly.
We did that to ourselves, and then we responded by increasing the number of such labs like fivefold, because apparently the answer was we needed more labs from which stuff could leak.
Exactly.
That's how we were going to be safer.
Well, I feel safer now.
Yeah, I don't look, when you start talking about weapons of mass destruction, I always say that at the end of the conversation, I feel like I need to be wearing a black cloak and carrying a scythe.
Yeah.
Because everybody in the room is just staring at their feet and they're completely silent, and you know, they just all want me to go away. So that's a really good question. It's definitely not for lack of interest. Sometimes the biggest impediments to terrorist groups fielding effective weapons are just really practical concerns. In other words, it's less about understanding the theory of how the plague works and more about just not having really competent professional lab techs to actually culture and grow the stuff. But I think, unfortunately, the consensus is that it is almost inevitable that we are going to see such an attack like in the next 5 to 10 years. And it, you know, if we're not ready for it, it could be huge. And here's the, I'll throw one other horrible thing in here just because I'm not depressing enough already. You know, things like the plague, for instance, which is the disease that in my book, everybody knows how to treat the plague. You can treat it with basically fairly straightforward antibiotics that have been known for a long time. But that doesn't mean that it's not effective. If a terrorist group launches a biological attack tomorrow, they're not going to send a proclamation a la some cheap movie saying we launched a biological attack. They're just going to start it. So people are going to start getting infected. Almost all these diseases start with flu-like symptoms, right? The famous flu-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first 24, 48 hours, you're feeling like garbage, but you don't think much of it. Eventually, you get ill enough with whatever disease we're talking about that you show up in the emergency room. Maybe somebody focuses on you and actually pays attention and notices the symptoms and raises the alarm. And maybe they tell you to take 2 aspirin and come back in the morning. Maybe they order some tests that take 2 or 3 days to come back. My point is that by the time anybody gets to the point where they realize that, hey, not only do we have a case of whatever, but we have hundreds of them, something's going on, we're going to be days and days and days into this event already. And every single person who has been infected will already, presuming it's transmittable human to human, will already have infected who knows how many other people who will have jumped on planes and boats and in cars and moved all over the place. And this becomes at some point kind of like a wildfire.
Right.
If you catch it early enough, you probably can put your hands around it and you actually have enough antibiotics. And if you don't, you lose it. And it is now spreading faster than you can possibly manufacture the drugs you need to kill it. And then you're basically waiting for it to burn itself out.
you already stated that it's almost inevitable that this will happen sometime in the next 5 to 10 years. But if you could wave your magic wand and change policy or change what we're doing in some way, is there something we could do that would at least decrease the likelihood of it happening?
Honestly, the very first thing that we should do is we should focus on the biological, the labs in this country that work with dangerous pathogens. When the anthrax attack started in 01, we had four BSL-4 labs in this country. That's the top most secure lab. Those are the ones that you see in all the movies with the moon suits and all that, right? We had four. We have 15 now. We had maybe 300 BSL-3 labs. Those are the ones just one tier down, but they work with some of the most commonly known most dangerous pathogens. So in other words, the plague and anthrax, all those things can be worked with at the BSL-3 level. There were roughly 300, something like that, in 01. There's like 1,500 of them now. Actually, nobody even knows how many there are. So that's how many more labs we got, and there's no one agency overseeing them all. And repeated government studies keep saying that their security and safety procedures are really inadequate. And we've got now thousands upon thousands and thousands of people working in these things with, you know, background checks in some cases, but limited. So before we get to worrying about a guy cooking up bugs for himself, we should be worried about the fact that some dude can just walk out of one of these labs with a test tube of anthrax or plague bacteria tomorrow. And his stuff grows, so he doesn't need to take as much as he's going to need for the attack. He just needs to take home, you know, basically the starter kit, and then culture whatever the quantity is he needs. If I was looking for the point of origin of the attack, the first place I would look would be the exact same place the last attack came from, which is inside one of our own laboratories.
Mm. We've got 2 minutes left, and I'm going to see if I can nail you down on one more question along this same topic, and that is, why do you think we did increase the count? Why did the government decide to keep adding labs, especially in light of what you're saying, but just in general, what's the point?
Well, it seemed like somehow or another that this would be a good idea that we know more about these things, but also because, frankly, people make a lot of money off of this.
Mm.
Because it's a place where we have this nexus again. You know, we're pumping a lot of money into this because there's government interest, and people can make a huge, huge amount of cash. I mean, you got everybody in the world now wants to have a bio lab and do research on anthrax and dangerous pathogens. It has become a homeland security thing, and you get cash.
Yeah, wasn't the anthrax attack just after 9/11, wasn't the motive for that to encourage the government to do more research on biological weapons? So that the person who got the stuff out of the military lab would get more money for his program? Wasn't that what Bill Boyle said?
I think that may have been one of his motives. I mean, if you've read through those case files, which I have, I mean, I think the real issue was that Ivins was coming completely unglued and had been for a long time, which raises a really interesting question, which is why we have a guy in the most allegedly most secure, most dangerous BSL-4 lab in the country, who everybody around him knows is going crazy, and yet he is allowed to retain access to anthrax. That's not encouraging.
The same circumstance applies to the Hood massacre, Fort Hood
yep.
massacre.
And yep.
He told everybody he was on a jihad long before he did it.
Everybody that knew him knew, hey, this guy needs to be out of here real fast.
Yep.
Well, we're out of time, and I still haven't had a chance to ask you about why it is that the CIA finally admitted that they masterminded the coup in 1953. So, Charles, I'm just going to have to get you by email or on the phone and try to get you back again. We're going to try one more time and see if we can get all of our questions answered.
Excellent. I'll think of more ways to evade it for the next time.
And we'll see all you next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Christ, the doors of souls, armies of salvation.